Hello, Daniel Browning with you. Welcome to Away, Indigenous Culture here on RN. Tonight, a strange ethnographic object and the mysterious Aboriginal man behind it. When the 130-year-old object was discovered in a French museum, it led a curator and her team on a journey into the history of scientific racism and the global trade where Indigenous people were trafficked abroad to perform in ethnographic shows or human zoos. One of those people was an 18-year-old bachelor man from Fraser Island off the Queensland coast.
In one sense, this is a sculpture made out of plaster of this man. On another level, it brings me very face to face with one of my forebears.
Yes, it's strange too for us to work and to try to understand what happens, why he's here, how he's coming here, and from where he comes.
Their power and skillfulness are really impressive. The audience was particularly interested in seeing them throw a boomerang.
It was the first time I saw living Australians. I have been so engaged with these strange people. I've seen so many pictures of the various tribes, studied so many skulls, that I am convinced they are quite excellent specimens of this race.
Anthropologists had these demands that the people serve as objects, but of course no person is an object, they are a subject by definition.
This is what human beings did to other human beings in the 19th century.
These three people were also exhibited at Dresden Zoo.
It's fair to say that without objects of material culture from Indigenous populations, there wouldn't be much to see in many European natural history museums. But the object at the centre of this program isn't an Aboriginal artefact. It's a haunting relic of European colonial history and the Western imagination. Tonight, we travel to the French city of Lyon, where the strange object is quite literally hidden away in a storage vault in a decommissioned museum. It's a relic in the truest sense of the word. So what is this strange ethnographic object? It's an extraordinarily detailed three-dimensional portrait in the form of a plaster cast of a young Aboriginal man bursting with health, posing as a boomerang thrower, about whom little else is known. The cast is so lifelike, when I saw it for the first time, I felt as though I was in the presence of a living person. Not a human remain, but the remains of a human. The question is, how did the cast of an Aboriginal man come to be there? This is Cast Among Strangers.
From the journal Das Ausland by H.V., 1882. Ein deutscher Ingenieur, welcher 18 Jahre auf dem australischen Kontinent beschäftigt war, had jetzt bei seiner Rückkehr. A German engineer who had worked in Australia for 18 years has now asked three natives of that continent to join him on his return and has, as a guide, made a round trip through the bigger towns of Germany. A. B. Meyer from Dresden measured the Aborigines' craniums and made plaster casts of the men's faces.
A reading from the popular German geographical journal Das Ausland, or The Foreign Country, published in 1882. What we know for certain is that in 1882, when this article was written, a group of three Aboriginal people from Fraser Island were in Europe with a German man named Louis Müller. The eldest in the group was a man called Gerono, and he was 22 years old. His niece, Barondera, was 15. The other traveller was an 18-year-old man, Bonangera, who went by the name Bonnie. And he is the man in the cast. The three travelled across Germany performing in zoos, parks, restaurants and a waxworks museum. From the seaport of Hamburg to Hanover to to Dresden, to Berlin and Leipzig, and then on to Basel in Switzerland.
The Australians, two men and one young girl, come from the colony of Queensland, north of the 29th latitude and east of the 141st longitude. The colony is 31,000 square miles in size, and hence bigger than Germany, Austria-Hungary, Switzerland and France combined. 173 inhabitants lived there in 1876, among which there were 5,109 Aborigines. So we are dealing with the representatives of a disappearing race, which should double the interest in viewing and observing them.
Inexplicably, by late August 1883, Bonny is travelling alone in France, his countrymen Gerono and Baronderer nowhere to be seen. In June last year, I went to Lyon to see the cast of Bonny, the strange ethnographic object I've been talking about. I find out later that the station where the train from Paris terminates was one of the last places where Bonny was known to have been seen. He was performing in a sort of caravan with a group of Indigenous people from the Russian Arctic. Almost 130 years later, I'm on the platform with the artist Fiona Foley, who has a strong personal interest in learning more about the cast and the man it represents.
Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour. Votre chef de bord, l'équipe TGV, je vais vous souhaiter la bienvenue à bord de ce train à destination de Lyon-Pardieu et Lyon-Perrache.
Fiona is a bachelorwoman whose work over many years has explored the colonial history of Fraser Island, her mother's country, and more broadly the entire state of Queensland from an Aboriginal perspective.
It feels a little bit jarring and a little bit sad because you know that you're retracing his steps that he would have made, maybe coming here on the train yesterday from Paris. I was thinking about how would he have travelled here to Lyon and what his journey would have been like and how people would have treated him back then in 1883. So there's lots of questions and very few answers.
I'm Lynette Russell. I'm an Australian Research Council Professorial Fellow at the Monash Indigenous Centre in the School of Journalism, Australian and Indigenous Studies, Monash University.
When I first approached you, what were your immediate thoughts about the story of Bonny?
My initial reaction was, of course, that he was one of many Aboriginal people who were taken overseas and displayed in various shows and human zoos and sideshows. And I wondered about him. I wondered what his life might have been like. Then you sent me the image of the cast, and I was really quite overwhelmed at the sheer humanity of him, something that I couldn't or haven't normally got from just the sort of two-dimensional images, photographs. I found the cast really quite deeply moving.
Dr. Lynette Russell, who's published widely on representations of race and indigeneity, and she's the Chair of Indigenous Studies at Monash University. As you'll hear, the taking of plaster casts of Indigenous people was not uncommon, but for the three documented groups of Aboriginal people who went to Europe in the 19th century, as far as I can tell, it's unheard of. And it's important to remember that of those three groups of Aboriginal performers, the Fraser Islanders are the first to reach Europe. The three Aboriginal people from Fraser Island were performers in staged ethnographic shows, or as they're known in Germany, Folkeschauen, literally people shows. Their performance included singing, dancing, boomerang throwing, and bizarrely, climbing trees.
Two Australian blacks from Queensland were guests for a short time and attracted many spectators in the Zoological Garden of Dresden on its so-called Völkerwiese, where in the recent past Eskimos, Sudanese, Hindus and representatives of other foreign tribes were presented to the public.
Völkerschauen or ethnic shows were a widespread form of mass entertainment in the late 19th and early 20th century in the United States but also in Europe. People from faraway countries were recruited for a limited span of time and they performed pursuits which were considered typical for their culture or region of origin. They performed in front of paying audiences. Often, but not always, they also went on tour through several cities or even countries. Völkerschauen have their roots in the huge world exhibitions, which started in Europe in the 1850s, where people from foreign countries were put on display. This was always a part of world exhibitions. Völkerschauen started as a very small-scale phenomenon in the early 19th century, but became huge mass spectacles after 1900, with up to 700 performers at the same time, with complete villages and background sceneries of local temples, houses, and other buildings, with animals and plants from the region. So they actually allowed the spectators the illusion of a travel to a faraway country without the costs and the risks of such a travel, and just for 50 pence entrance fee. But in the 1880s, when the three Aboriginal people from Fraser Island traveled with an ethnic show, these shows had not reached such an elaborate staging, but usually consisted of just a few acts shown during a performance.
Dr. Hilke Torda Aurora, a cultural anthropologist who's widely acknowledged as an expert in the history of the Völkerschauen. At the time the three Fraser Islanders were in Germany, most Europeans had never seen a living Aboriginal person, let alone three of them. Nor had they ever seen a boomerang or the sacred musical instrument known as a bullroarer.
Their presentations are limited to throwing spears and a wooden piece called a boomerang that, similar to a dove's flight, in a broad curve cuts the air and returns to the starting point. Furthermore, they create strange sounds by swinging a toy that consists of a little piece of wood attached to the end of a whipcord. They climb with great agility onto the 40-meter-high trunk of a tree without bark, by grasping the trunk like monkeys and step against it with the feet. In all these exercises, just as when performing simple dances and singing, they develop a smooth agility, which in their national costumes, consisting of loose jackets and trousers made of woolen fabric, gives a nice impression.
Interestingly, all ethnic shows which I have come across, irrespective of the participants' region of origin, irrespective of the staging, had three elements: music, dance, and fighting elements. And you also see that in the performances which are given in the sources about the three Aboriginal people.
When I first mentioned the story of Bonnie and the other two Fraser Islanders, were you at all surprised by that particular story?
Not at all, no. The only thing that surprised me a little bit was to hear of a full body cast, because I haven't come across that till now.
One thing I think that's especially interesting in the case of Bonnie is that he was subjected to a full body plaster cast, and that was probably the most difficult thing to get somebody to do. All of these people were, while very much constrained, were free people and had to be convinced to be subjected to anthropological study. Having a plaster cast take at this time, it was with gypsum plaster. And even if it wasn't adulterated with lime, which sometimes it was, the gypsum plaster, it burned. People had to sit for, I think, about 40 minutes to get the cast hardened. And, of course, Bonnie, if it's a full body cast, it would have been multiple pieces. And this would have been 40 minutes not just of staying still in a kind of discomforting and uncomfortable and objectifying position, but also to feel a discomfort and a burn, and even if it was adulterated, the plaster, even actually causing burns on the body. So it wasn't easy to get people to agree to do this, and it could be some combination of incentives and coercion that could have led to this particular case, but that's certainly how plaster casts normally came about.
Andrew Zimmerman, Associate Professor of History from George Washington University in Washington, D.C., who's written about the history of German anthropology in the late 19th century as a form of imperialism.
Anthropologists preferred to deal with objects, with body parts, with skulls mostly, but other body parts too, or with artifacts. And so these Völkerschauen have kind of an interesting role, because on the one hand, anthropologists mostly didn't travel in this period. So the only contact they had with living examples of the people they studied were through these Folkerschauer, often the only, and certainly the major contact they had was through these Folkerschauer. And anthropologists had these demands that the people serve as objects, but of course no person is an object. They are a subject by definition. And what they hoped to do was to create a science of humans, a science that would create general knowledge about humans that wasn't a historical science or a humanistic science, or what we would today maybe call a social science, one based on interpreting what humans said and what humans did. But what they thought of it, of these sciences as, were kind of an objective science, a science of people who they could treat as objects, people who they could get objective knowledge about, that is knowledge about artifacts, about body parts, and people who, in their view, were natural, people who were outside of history, outside of culture. And these happened to be the people that were mostly being subject to colonial rule, either German colonial rule or other European colonial rule in the 19th century.
Andrew Zimmerman. Christine Artenor was, up until the past few years, the curator of the African and Oceanian Collection at the Musée de Confluence, formerly the Museum of Natural History in Lyon. It was Christine who, in a sense, found the cast of Bonnie, and who began the work to identify who he was and how he came to be there. She says the first clue in discovering who he was came after they found individual casts, moulages, of the hands and feet of an unidentified person. The only firm clue to their origin was a handwritten note in pencil on the underside of the casts of the feet. The words, Bonnie, Australienne, and the date, 1883.
We discover, in fact, the moulage and the Bonnie and other people or other piece from people. And Bonnie is special because he's totally, and he's made on his body. And it's very, very impressive, in fact, to discover him and to discover him in special position too, of course. Yes, it's strange too for us to work and to try to understand what happens, why is here, how is coming here, and from where he comes.
Arnaud Morvan is a researcher in art and anthropology whose PhD fieldwork at the University of Melbourne included time working with the senior Gidja artists in the Kimberley. And it was an article he wrote about the Musée de Confluence and the problematic nature of some museum collections in Europe that first drew me into the story of the cast of the young man known as Bonnie.
When I first saw Bonnie, as a cast of Bonnie in the storage room of the museum, I wasn't expecting to see him, and I was a bit almost shocking to see the face of someone looking so real, and it was really confronting. I have the feeling to feel the presence of the person that was there at the time of when they were doing the cast, and they captured his image in three dimension at the exact point in time, and it was just put in front of me just now. So it's almost like being in contact with the past and with, you know, how someone was at a special time in history, and especially the fact that I knew at the time that Australian performers that were taken from Australia to tour in Europe were traveling in very, sometimes very hard conditions, and sometimes were treated pretty cruelly. And so it was there was also this idea of did he want to have his cast made, or what did he feel about it? But then also looking at his face, he has a very strong facial impression, and he looks also, for me, I think he looks kind of proud too. So it's that was a very mixed feeling about discovering this object, because it is also an object. But yeah, it was really confronting. I know that despite what a lot of people think in Europe and even so in Australia, that Aboriginal culture is not really about history. From my background working on the East Kimberley, where there is very strong memories of the past, and it's very present in everyday life and in the art. I knew that what happened even 100 years ago was still very important for Aboriginal people back in Australia. So yes, you have this feeling of looking at this object as a piece of history, and I knew that people in Australia, Aboriginal people would be very interested into getting in contact with this cast.
So we make some research, of course, and in the archives. We first initiate by the archives of the museum, and we call the archives, the archives of the city of Lyon, and they ask them if they have some photography, some text, or some things like that. We have made research too on the paper, old papers, but it's difficult, in fact, to make identification, precise identification on Bonnie and who is he really. And the research we have made do not give exactly the name of Bonnie and who he's from and his family and if he have children or wife or yes, the we could research too. It's very strange. Of course, it's incredible that man was here in this year. They are here, in fact. And so they make them show to people what they are like, perhaps animals, I don't know, but like in circus or it's like that, in fact. Yes, and we discover that too, and we discover that it's our French people who have done that, and it's a little bit difficult for us to understand that, to see that, and it's another time, sure, but it gives some question to us too, of course.
The mummified remains of an Aborigine have been found in the United States and identified as those of a man abducted more than a century ago. Tambo Tambo was one of nine Aborigines kidnapped in North Queensland and forced to join a travelling circus. Now, the man's descendants are asking for help to bring to an end his spiritual exile.
That's how ABC Television News reported the discovery of the remains of Tambo, an Aboriginal performer in the ethnographic shows, who died in the American city of Cleveland in the winter of 1884. He was in a group of nine people from Palm and Hinchinbrook Islands who were brought to the United States by Robert A. Cunningham, a Canadian who was in the business of staging ethnographic displays. The mortality rate among Aboriginal people who went overseas to perform in the ethnographic shows was very high. Of the 20 Aboriginal people we know of who went overseas in the last two decades of the 19th century, at least 15 of them died of diseases like pneumonia and tuberculosis. Their story might never have been told were it not for Dr. Rosalind Poignant, who explored the repressed history of the Aboriginal performers in her 2004 book, Professional Savages, Captive Lives and Western Spectacle. We may never know if they were coerced or if they went willingly. Did Bonnie and the other Fraser Islanders simply cooperate with their guide Louis Mueller, or did they see it as a way to earn a living? Certainly some Indigenous people were exploited, some were mistreated, and some even abandoned by the impresarios. But there's another current in the debate.
There are aspects of it where I think they probably did feel they were putting on a show and that they did have a certain amount of control. Perhaps I'm being overly optimistic, but I mean, to think otherwise is just almost unbearable. Kind of re-inscribes trauma in a way that I'm not sure that is helpful. But I do think that they did put on a show. They were performers. And a lot of those early dime museums, the kind of things that Barnum put on, where he had, all sorts of so-called freaks, or he had, he either had people that we would now today call people with disabilities, or indeed native peoples from around the world. And they had a certain degree of control. Now, I'm not saying they had all the control that they might want, but certainly they had more control than we might imagine.
One of the things that's happening in history of imperialism broadly, including history of anthropology, is this attempt to both acknowledge the agency of the colonized or of people who are being treated as colonial others, like Bonnie, to acknowledge their agency without minimizing the overwhelming power of Europeans, colonizers. And so it's sort of a tension, because on the one hand, you want to say Bonnie was, I assume, like most of these performers, was taking an active part, may have agreed to go along. Sometimes people were enslaved when they went to Europe, but sometimes they went along out of the same kind of sense of adventure that Europeans sometimes went to the colonies or went abroad and hoped to make money, or sometimes hoped to learn a trade, for example, in the imperial capital, and many of them stayed. But then, of course, they were in very unequal power relations once they arrived. Was it a trip of interest? Was it to make money? Were they coerced in some way? Did they hope to stay and learn a trade or attend a mission school, for example, in Germany? All of these things could have happened. It could be also sort of entrepreneurial on the part of the person who was being displayed, who was performing.
What really strikes me, even after the long months in the Völkerschau travel, which must have made them weary and tired, and some of them fell ill on the way, even if you look at the late sources written in 1883, you found similar descriptions of the three personalities. It is always mentioned that they are earnest, that they are silent, that they are good-natured, that they are friendly disposed. It gives me the impression of earnest, level-headed, responsible personalities. And this is especially true for the man called Bonnie. It is also mentioned that he became Louis Müller's roommate whenever they lived in a hotel at the different tour stops, and that Louis Müller praised him a lot and relied on him a lot. So this is a glimpse of Bonnie's agency. It's not so much a master-slave relationship, which is the way Völkerschau are often seen, but I see Bonnie as a person who probably had a lot of agency in forming what was happening in the Völkerschau and influencing Müller what to do or not to do, perhaps.
There seems to have been trust and friendship between the two, just based on those small pieces of information that we have.
I don't know whether one could go as far as saying friendship, but I would definitely say trust.
Dr. Hilke Torda Aurora. This is Cast Among Strangers, and you're listening to Away, Indigenous Culture here on RN. For a long time, I convinced myself that the cast of Bonnie was a man in a photograph in the archives of the State Library of Queensland. That man was Kabunya, from the Wandana clan of the Butchala people from Fraser Island. I also managed to convince myself that he somehow survived the trip to Europe. Kabunya was also known as Willie, or simply as Great. He was a skilled tracker and was recruited from Fraser Island to help find Ned Kelly. He also joined a troop of boomerang throwers in the 1890s, led by Archibald Meston, who went on to become the Queensland Protector of Aborigines. When he died in the late 1940s, Kabunya was said to have been 100 years old. And he's the great-great-grandfather of the artist Fiona Foley.
There's a historical photograph of Kabunya from the State Library in Queensland, and we thought that the plaster cast looked very similar to Kabunya, and there is like a family resemblance with Kabunya and some of my relatives. So We thought initially that it could be the same person, but it's not because the dates don't line up. But he definitely, he has a family type resemblance about him, but we can't ascertain that for sure. So it's still a bit of a mystery, apart from the fact that he comes from Fraser Island. Well, there's definitely a lot of different clan groups from Fraser Island, but the nation wasn't huge in number, and probably after the early times of frontier war being carried out in the district, numbers were also lessened, you know, through the efforts of the native mounted police and so on and so forth. So Fraser Island people weren't big in number, that's for sure. But him coming here as a traditional man, you know, the circumstances for that would have been so incredible. How did they come about? How was he picked up with two other Fraser Island people to be part of this touring that took place here in that particular time? And, you know, anthropologists over here in Germany in particular were looking at different races and trying to work out how we figured in the larger family tree. And just reading Rosalind Poignant's book, like, these three people were also exhibited at Dresden Zoo. So there was like a scientific inquiry into different races around the world, and how would he have been treated, him along with the two other Fraser Island people, and what sort of curiosities there would have been to the general public here in France and Germany. So it's very puzzling that we don't know very much about what took place to them here in Europe.
We'll probably never know how the people from Fraser Island felt about their experiences. The only sources are, of course, written from the perspective of the curious in illustrated magazines and the German anthropological journals. This account is from the popular weekly geographical journal Das Ausland, published in 1883 under the heading Australian Blacks in Germany.
Their religion is very unclear. The native idiom sounds soft and melodic and is spoken euphoniously by the 14-year-old girl. Men and women go completely naked in the homeland and wear a loincloth at most to cover their nakedness. Due to decency and the colder climate, they wear European clothes here. It has to be surprising that the men have already adopted so much of the European sense of decency that they behave more or less bashfully during a physical examination.
I mean, sometimes you see encounters where the people being measured and studied resisted, and that's also interesting because it's a point of contact between anthropologist and the people anthropologists study that was relatively rare in the late 19th century and even into the early 20th century.
It was the first time I saw living Australians. I have been so engaged with these strange people. I've seen so many pictures of the various tribes, studied so many skulls, that I am convinced they are quite excellent specimens of this race. Especially Bonnie and the young girl. They are truly magnificent specimens.
A little growth of a beard appears above the wide mouth with excellently developed teeth. The wide head is covered with frizzy black hair. The eyes a little sunk but agile and dark colored under a low forehead. The way they seem to grasp the tree with the great toes when climbing led to an assumption they have a suppleness similar to that of the thumb. But this was showed to be incorrect. The great toe is not formed, positioned, or developed differently from that of the Caucasian race.
The most important thing for me was to become acquainted firsthand and from my own examination with their complexion and the texture of their hair. They were wrapped in certain mystery.
Both are colorblind and can only recognize black and white exactly. Their knowledge about figures is really underdeveloped. They can count up to five only. Also, they don't have distinctive names for the fingers, as many tribes have, but distinguish only the thumb by a specific name.
So there are these types of things going on, intellectual discussions going on that are really all about understanding the, what I might call the edges of the room. What, how on earth did this extraordinary world that they've only really begin to understand in the 19th century, post the 18th century, when the new world opens up, Australia opens up, and then they start to really have to find ways of explaining human difference. And they do things that we would think most peculiar. I mean, anthropologists go up to the Torres Strait and take, you know, arm strengthening tests with them to see how strong their arms are. They take all sorts of interesting things to record people's capacity for recognising different colours, because they simply don't know what other human beings are capable of doing. They're trying to understand that. Now, that's me putting a very optimistic and glossy spin on it. There's no doubt that there's also some pretty ghastly things going on at the same time, and the collection of human skulls and human remains is part of that. And these are not necessarily and not always merely the collection of deceased individuals. We know for a fact that there are occasions when people are actually, in a sense, harvested for their remains. So a number of things are going on at the same time.
From the Journal of the Berlin Society for Anthropology, Ethnology and Prehistory, February 17, 1883. The European clothing which they wear might hide not an inconsiderable part of the peculiar, what usually describes the Australian. Nevertheless, much of it is visible. That, at least to me, the impression of strangeness was emphasized in a much greater degree than I have ever received at the sight of an alien race. My understanding is that the particularity of the Australian physiognomy culminates in the formation of the nasal region. Especially, therefore, Bonnie is a real prototype.
The two men, the older of whom being the girl's uncle, are slim and strong. The colour of their skin is a light chocolate brown, appearing somehow lighter on the back and on the palm of their hands, and somehow darker at the neck. Feet and hands are small, sinewy and well-formed, with light, long nails on which even the white half-moons are visible. Wrist joints and ankle joints are fine. Whereas the musculature of arm and thigh seems to be strongly developed, the calf is comparably thin.
We can only imagine how the Fraser Islanders might have felt about being obliged to undergo physical examinations and detailed anthropometric tests with calipers and other measuring devices. In Berlin, they were brought by Louis Müller to the rooms of the German scientist Rudolf Virchow, who reported his findings to the Berlin Society of Anthropology, Ethnology and Prehistory in early 1883. No doubt the physical examinations would have been particularly distressing for the young woman, Baronderer. We know that she refused to take off her clothes. But I've also seen copies of the casts made of the group in Dresden, and it's plain to see how traumatised she was by that particular experience. As you follow Baronderer's journey through the historical sources, the accounts of her differ altogether.
I cannot say these people make overall an unfavourable impression, especially the young girl, who is decidedly friendly and pleasant. She is inclined to cheerfulness and shows great interest in things, however, without casting off a certain restraint.
The girl, however, proved to be very shy, closed and shamefaced. She didn't answer any questions put to her, and only after mentioning her name, Baronderer, did she become more trustful. The girl makes a completely virginal impression, and that seems to be even more impressive, as in the hot sun of her homeland, the girls enter the age of puberty early. While travelling, she is being carefully protected from any temptation by her leader, and upon the question whether she was not yet married, she answers with a bashful smile, "Master won't allow it." The men never attended school. However, they showed their natural skill when they were given a pencil. In the manner of a 10-year-old child, but in a way that was completely recognizable, one drew a bird, the other a big fish eating a little one, as he explained with a wide, sweet-tempered smile.
Both drink beer and smoke cigars instead of homemade clay pipes. Nurono is so deeply influenced by Western cultures that sometimes he drinks too much alcohol. The unspoiled Bonangera expresses his disgust on these occasions. With the trust of children of nature, they have complete faith in their leader, who believes he can rely on Bonangera under all circumstances. At the end of the presentation, Benanyora usually began singing. The song was similar to the monotone Negro melodies of America, and Yorono danced to it.
At some time after this account was published, Bonnie's countryman, Gerono, and his niece, Barondra, were taken ill and sent to hospital in Cologne. We don't know if they succumbed or recovered and joined Bonnie later. And that's because the archives of the city of Cologne were destroyed in a building collapse in 2008. So we'll probably never know. You're listening to Away Indigenous Culture on RN, and this is Cast Among Strangers, produced in 2011. I met with Fiona Foley in her hotel next to the former ice skating rink, or Ice Palace, which until recently housed the Museum of Natural History in Lyon.
Well, I studied sculpture at art school, and we were also a part of that training was we did do plaster casts. And so you understand like the technique of like moulding. So in one sense, this is a sculpture made out of plaster of this man. On another level, it brings me very face to face with one of my forebears. And so that's a closeness that we will have with this plaster cast, but we won't have in any other way. We don't have a photograph of him. We don't have any written records of him. But you come face to face with an elder from your nation, and that's as close as we're going to get.
Let's get to the museum.
Okay.
Bonjour, it's Daniel Browning here for Claire Brizol.
We're in the storage area in the old building on the Boulevard de Belge that once housed the ethnographic collections of the Museum of Natural History in Lyon. The museum closed its doors to the public in 2007, while a more futuristic building is constructed about 10 minutes away, at the confluence of the Rhône and the Saône, the two rivers that run through the old Roman city. I'm in the storage room where the cast of Bonnie stands undercover, and I'm with Fiona Foley, Arnaud Morvan, and the curator, Claire Brizon.
For sure. Oh, no, anyone can do it. Oh, pull away. Oh, okay. Wow. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, those are like the little scars from Fraser Island. Yeah.
For a long time, the cast was known simply as the Australian.
Amazing.
Or the boomerang thrower, lançant le boomerang.
It's very thin, isn't it?
Nowadays, the museum staff, who are just as interested as we are in the provenance of the object and the history of the individual, refer to the cast of Bonnie by his name. Veins in the hand. Precisely because the cast is so lifelike and in such a remarkable state of preservation, they handle him gently like he's a human being. If you look at the cast through post-colonial eyes, it's the object and the Western imagination that created it, and not the man it represents, that becomes the curiosity.
Wow, that's great. I feel good.
It's confronting, though.
It is in one way, because you come face to face with history, but in another way, I feel good that I've seen them, yeah, and can touch it, and you know, no one really knows about him. He's been forgotten about. No one talks about him. Yeah.
It's interesting for us, for the museum, because we have a history of museum of castle in museum, and today. Vous apportez aussi, enfin, vous reprenez l'histoire et vous la continuez, en fait.
You're kind of taking back the history and keep going with it. So
yeah.
It's good for us too.
Yeah. It's interesting, mais, enfin, c'est une nouvelle,
yeah.
A new life for...
Yes, it is good.
Unlike the remains of Tambo and those of Truganini, which were on display at the Tasmanian Museum well into the 20th century, the cast of Bonnie hasn't been seen in public for more than 100 years. And according to the former curator of the Oceanian Collection at the Musée de Confluence, Christine Utenor, the only way the cast will ever be seen again is if the Bachelor community wants it.
I could not decide to show him like that, sure. But we would like, in fact, to propose to Australian or Aboriginal people, Australian, to see him, to work around him, to have a relation with him and with us, of course, because it helps us to understand what it has done in the past.
I think it's a shame to hide it and to not tell his story and to not show his cast. But on the other hand, showing his cast very directly could be a bit disturbing and could be reproducing this kind of show or kind of entertainment of let's have a look at the you know, savage. Or so it has to, I think there is many indirect way to show this piece, yeah.
It is actually really important not to re-anthropologize them, but it's also, I think, immensely important to look at them, to actually learn from them, and to understand that this is what human beings did to other human beings in the 19th century, but also to understand that the representation of them is not them. It is a representation. Notwithstanding all the things I've said before about agency and everything else, this is still a representation. This is not Bonnie. It is a representation. We're never going to get his perspective, and that's one of the tragedies. You know, you dream that he left a journal behind or he left some notebook somewhere, but he didn't. And we're never going to get his perspective. But there are those little clues that we were talking about before that I think we must take heed of. And no, we shouldn't re-anthropologize it, but we certainly shouldn't ignore it. That's terribly important.
A lot of the ideological and political structures that were created at the end of the 19th century, structures of inequality, of discrimination, of a sense of devaluing some people's histories and overvaluing other people's histories, are very much with us today. Aimé Césaire, who's writing shortly after the Second World War, and he was dealing with this issue of a division between people with history and people without history. And he says that, you know, there's been a kind of a European humanism that has been as much an anti-humanism, a human that denies humanity to most of the world. And he says what we need is to criticize the blind spots of this European humanism, in order to get what he calls a humanism made to the measure of the world. That is not a humanism made to the measure of European empires, but a humanism made to the measure of the world. And I think the kind of research that you're doing on Bonnie is exactly what I think has to be done to begin to kind of undo the damage caused by that Eurocentric humanism.
Fiona, we're back together after some months and after a time in Lyon. I guess I'm trying to find out what you've been thinking about Bonnie and about the Fraser Islanders. just what you're thinking.
The trip to Lyon seems like a lifetime ago. Although it was only probably about 3 or 4 months, I've had a chance to reflect on a little bit of the history associated with them going over, and probably what stayed with me was the memory of him travelling, Bonnie travelling with the Laplanders, and what that would have felt like, and being so isolated, being the only bachelor person there and the only Australian Aboriginal in a circus entourage. So I think like the loneliness of it all, that idea stayed with me, and seeing his plaster cast and walking away from it also permeates my memory of that day.
The Australian blacks like their stay among civilized people. They have learned the value of money and are thankful for small gifts. Only they already think it is cold, and one of the men has been afflicted with a heavy cough. But they believe that next year, after their return, 10 boys will make the same journey.
I think he would have passed away over there. That's my gut feeling, that he would have probably not come back to these shores. I suspect he would have passed away in Europe, and for me and my relatives, that's still a big piece of the mystery. Where is his body? Where could he be resting? Where did he end up?
Cast Among Strangers was produced in 2011 by me, Daniel Browning, with technical production by Kerry Dell. And the program won a bronze medal in the World's Best Radio Awards at the 2012 New York Festival. The readers were James Saunders and Peter Murdoch. The beautiful music in this program was West, a composition by Suzanne Crome. You can see a gallery of images, including an image of the cast of Bonnie, in an album on our website. Just find Away in the program menu on the left-hand side at abc.net.au/radionational.
Caught in that little city like a prison.
The life of some migrant workers can be lonely and dangerous.
There's no way that you can be free.
But still, every day, thousands travel abroad in search of work.
Sometimes I cannot sleep, but I try to be strong just for my family and for my small daughter.
Now, a series on the rise of migrant labour across Asia. To download or stream, look for Workers Without Borders on the RN homepage.